Little Hen Life,
a podcast of the cinema,
hosted by me. My name's Dave White.
I was going to say, did you blank on that part?
I'm a very important film critic.
Yes.
Also, here's my sidekick. His name's Alonzo Duralde. He's somebody somewhere sometime, I guess.
I am not your sidekick.
What is it? What is it you do? Tell them what you do.
I'm the first of all, I'm the total boss of you. Hi, I'm Alonzo Duralde. I'm the film reviews editor at The Wrap, co-host of the Who Shot You podcast on the Maximum Fun Network, co-host of What the Flick on the Young Turks Network.
Yes. So, also, you're the guy who gets his picture taken with Agnes Varda.
This is true.
You're the only one.
I am that guy. No. There were several.
It was
people,
a line.
Pretty much.
It was a line to get a picture date with Agnes Varda.
Well, the real mob was across the aisle at the Spirit Awards for everyone taking pictures with young Timmy Chalamet.
Timmy.
But yes, I saw quite a few Agnes Varda pictures floating around as well.
What?
And that was the one celeb photo I wanted from the event.
Of course. You were at the Independent Spirit Awards on Saturday afternoon.
Yes.
And you took your event husband, Tom.
Yes, my plus one.
I stayed away because that's what I like.
Yes.
Although, you know, when I did see the Agnes Varda picture, I thought, oh, see, sometimes it would be good if you went.
Uh-huh.
You could get your picture taken with Agnes Varda. She'll never remember that. But I could be the kind of person I hate, and I would let myself be the kind of person I hate just for that moment.
And what kind of person is that?
The kind that gets their picture taken with celebrities.
Oh, come on.
No, seriously. You know I don't like that.
I mean, yes, and 99 times out of 100, I'm...
But it was her.
I agree with you, but it's Agnes Varda.
But it was Agnes Varda, so that's like, you know...
It's like...
You get a pass.
Yes, please.
There's always a pass.
She is a deity.
She's the pass.
Yes.
You know, anyone else of her stature would not even allow it.
Probably.
But she's very kind.
She is.
And she likes to make the friends.
Yes. I mean, like, in all the time I have known you, have you ever seen me take a picture with a celebrity that wasn't, like, work-related?
No, never.
See? So there.
Yeah.
Let me have this one.
No, I'm not saying that you are being bad or okay. That you were being bad. I'm saying that, you know...
As a rule.
As a rule that occasionally, in moments like those, must be broken.
Yes.
You were right to mob her and demand a photo and stealing a piece of her soul with your camera.
I asked politely before stealing a piece of her soul. Thank you very much. So she photographs everybody. It's like, you know.
She does. She's the one always taking the pictures of other people.
Yeah.
Right. While you were getting your picture taken with her, I was at a literal movie theater literally watching her film, Faces Places, Visage Village.
Thank you.
Yeah. And I took visiting out-of-town friend Joe, and I took...
Neighbor Gary.
Neighbor, always in town, always at our house eating, Gary. They both loved it.
And well, they should.
And
I wish the Academy felt the same way.
Which movie won the documentary award?
Icarus.
Icarus.
Is not bad.
I didn't get around to watching it because I just can't hear any more about Russia.
I had been putting it off. I finally watched it last week for What the Flick. And it's well done, but it is one of those movies where the guy literally... stumbled upon a huge story.
Oh.
It starts out...
What was the point? What was he going to be making a documentary about?
It starts out like Super Size Me. You've got this guy. He's like a first-time filmmaker. He's an amateur bicyclist.
Okay.
And every year he does this thing called the Oat Route, which is sort of like the amateur Tour de France.
Okay.
But super hard and super challenging and lots of uphills. And
so he's an amateur bicyclist the way that the people on Great British Bake Off are amateur bakers.
Exactly. Okay. He hasn't gone pro, but he's just under that level.
Better than everyone else that you know.
Yes.
Just not pro.
Just not pro.
All right.
So he, in previous years, had ranked like 14th.
Oh.
Which is not bad, but you know, he wanted to crack the top 10. So he had this idea, what if I dope, but I do it in such a way that it's medically supervised so that I will pass all the pee tests.
Is it legal to do that?
It's not. But I mean, he was basically, he was documenting this whole thing. Ostensibly, he was
like, I'm a dope for the documentary.
Yes. And to prove.
I'm going
to
eat at McDonald's all day.
Exactly. And to prove okay. that you could dope and get away with it because like Lance Armstrong and all these people.
You can.
Did and do yes. get away with it.
Yeah.
So originally, the guy who was going to sort of guide him through this was somebody at one of the labs at UCLA, I think. UCLA or USC, I forget.
Right.
And then he's like, he gets cold feet. He's like, I have a professional reputation. You should talk to my friend Gregory in Russia. So Gregory, who is quite the character, via Skype starts like, telling this guy what the doses are and when to take them. And yes. Da-da-da-da.
Right.
And like this dude's having to like freeze his urine samples so they can send them, so they can be smuggled into Russia. So this guy can test them at a certified lab of the WADA, the World Anti-Doping Agency.
Okay.
And then it turns out that Gregory is the guy who blows the whistle on the fact that like every Russian athlete is doping. Like the chess players are doping. Everybody.
What? Why would a chess player do it?
No, I'm kidding.
Okay.
But like every
you were being serious.
Every actual athlete is all doping.
Right. Yeah.
And it becomes, and that's what starts this whole international scandal. And of course then the International Olympic Committee comes out as one of the villains in all this because
you don't say.
Because they can't be bothered to bar Russia from the 2016 Olympics in Rio.
Yeah.
They did finally this year bar them, but they've already said they're not going to do it in 2020.
They're not going to do what?
They're not going to bar Russia from participating.
Whether they dope or not dope?
Even though Russia is like flagrantly, rampantly, obviously busted, stone cold guilty of doping.
Well, then why are they allowing them in?
Because the IOC is a bunch of wusses. I don't know.
What can Russia do to them? Nothing.
I'm sure it's all look the whole IOC thing. There's so much. It's so much about like money and sponsorships and bribes and God knows what. That's a documentary waiting to be made. But anyway, so it just happened that this guy was making a doc about something else entirely, and then his co-subject is at the middle of this whole thing. And, you know, I remember when Citizen 4 happened.
Yes.
There were people who were like, well, yeah, I mean, it's a great story, but is it a good documentary?
Right.
And I would say, yes, it is a good documentary, and it's a really suspenseful documentary. And this one is fine, but it feels like it's a TV news magazine that got lucky, you know.
Who could watch Faces Places on the Academy Committee and not see how like lovely and perfect it is,
well,
and not vote for it?
You know, here's the thing.
Who are these people?
The thing that I've discovered over the years about the Spirit Awards, you
yes.
know, is that the people who are on the nominating jury, the nominating committee, see everything.
Yes.
They see a ton of movies and yep. they nominate stuff that people haven't heard of, that maybe have only played at festivals, that haven't been released theatrically yet. And then the voters vote. And the voters
don't have to see
everything.
You're not obliged
yeah.
to see everything.
So the same thing happens with the Academy. Unless you've got somebody who is spending a lot of money and making a really concerted effort to make people watch things,
right.
you have no way of knowing if they've ever watched them or not.
Icarus was on Netflix, right?
Icarus was on Netflix. Icarus had Netflix pushing it.
Yes.
Is this Netflix's first Oscar?
Maybe. I don't know.
Anyway, but that, you know, and it had the benefit of super timeliness. Like it was
Russia's being bad.
Exactly.
Right.
The Olympics just happened, you know, so it had the whole zeitgeist behind it. But I mean, come on, Faces Places. It's so great.
Do you think that of the people who saw them all, do you think that older voters, rather than feeling a sense of loyalty toward an 89-year-old filmmaker,
mm-hmm.
a legend, do you think that perhaps they were actually turned off by the lack of a, you know, forward-moving narrative? Because it does faces, places, meanders.
Right.
Just like its subjects.
Here's what I think.
Just like its people.
The Academy's made a huge improvement about this specific thing over the years, but I think it somewhat still hangs over this category.
Yeah.
For a long time, you had people on the dock who were watching the docs who were really kind of grading on the importance curve.
Yes.
And so it was like, drag queens in Harlem. Who cares?
Was it nominated?
No,
was Paris Burning not. Not even nominated.
Nope. Young kids playing basketball in the inner city. Who cares?
Right.
Where's the documentary about like pollution and the Holocaust and you know the refugee children?
Yes.
So I will say, I bet there's probably a lot of people who are like, well, this is a nice movie about art and stuff.
Right.
But, you know, the Russian doping, it's a big deal.
It's important.
It's important. This was news.
I see.
Okay. Well. Just a theory. I mean, because they didn't. It's not like they picked Last Man in Aleppo, you know.
Right. Right. Which is also important.
Exactly.
Right. Fine. We watched the Academy Awards. Here's our wrap-up. Emily Blunt had the best dress.
You think?
I think.
I liked it, but I don't know if that would say it was the best.
That was my favorite dress.
I really liked I liked Jane Fonda's a lot.
The one that Jane Fonda looked great. She had that Dina Merrill bullet hair.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the dress that Tiffany Haddish wore to the ceremony on the red carpet was incredible. And would have been the best dress of the night had she kept it on.
Instead,
she stayed committed to the bits. And she wore that white gown.
It's Alexander McQueen, right?
I think it is.
That she wore to the premiere of Girls Trip on Saturday Night Live.
And then again in a sketch on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, on Weekend Update. And then I think to the New York Film Critics Circle?
I don't know, but probably.
She's trucked it out a lot, and she's made a joke out of it.
And she's made a joke out of it. It's now a running gag.
Yeah.
And she did it again last night. And when they said she was coming on stage, I thought, oh, I get to see that kick-ass dress again with the headpiece and everything that she had on. And then it was the joke dress.
Which is a great dress. It's just
it's beautiful. It's a very beautiful, really normal formal gown.
She's totally goofing on this notion that like women aren't allowed to wear the same thing more than once. Like she is amortizing that dress.
Yeah. No, and you know what? That's what real people do.
Yeah. No, I think it's brilliant.
Please, I wear the same damn thing every year to the LAFCO Awards. I got my go-to.
Not entirely.
Kinda.
You mix it up a bit.
Ever so lightly, and it's all dependent on. What size is my waist that year? What pants are in the closet that are for me right now?
That will accommodate.
What jacket? I own exactly 3 jackets. Which one fits me? Thanks to my super belly.
I wore one of your jackets
to my beautiful, beautiful belly.
To the Spirit Awards.
You did.
And I got some compliments.
Everybody complimented you. Oh, no, that one, that jacket.
It's gorgeous.
It's gorgeous, and that's that chocolate brown, and it is so soft.
Yeah.
And people come up, and if they touch it, they're like, oh, I like to touch it. Yeah.
I had a nice JCRT shirt to go with it.
Yep, everything. Better. You looked really nice.
Thank you.
The best dressed at the Spirit Awards was Agnes Varda.
Oh, yes, in a her purple tracksuit.
Electric purple tracksuit. it's perfect. That's perfect.
Yeah.
She should have wore that to the Oscars.
For the respect they showed her, yes.
Yes.
Did you see what she was wearing?
This beautiful sort of caftan-y looking
thing. Yeah, it was sort of part caftan, part kimono.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure it was very comfortable.
Yeah.
Which is what you want.
Oh, yeah.
When you're 89 years old, or 88, I guess.
89. She'll be 90 this year.
She'll be 90 this year. When you're 89 years old, you're like, sure, it would be nice to look nice,
This show is how many hours?
Get me a pillow to sit on. A little head pillow to lean back on. Nice little a drink, a cup of tea, perhaps.
Apparently, Jimmy Kimmel put snack boxes under all the seats.
Oh, did he?
Yes.
What kind of snacks, though?
It was a mix of things, but it was like, you know, nuts and chips and cookies.
I see. Well, at least he...
He did not have the hot dog cannon in there.
See, that's what... I'll take the hot dog cannon. Army Hammer, shoot that hot dog cannon toward me. I'll have a couple hot dogs, please.
That, I will say, like, that bit was pretty strained, and it was annoying that they spent time on that and not on, oh, Agnes Varda winning the governor's award last fall.
Yeah, yeah.
But the sight of Army Hammer in that resplendent red velvet tuxedo.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Firing a hot dog cannon
at a bunch of kids. Yeah. A bunch of high kids.
Yeah, that's what somebody
said. They weren't children. They were like young adults, and they were all stoned.
Can you imagine getting stoned and going to see A Wrinkle in Time, and the movie stops halfway through, and Guillermo del Toro walks in with a sub sandwich?
Yeah, yeah. Hey, I'll take a bite of that sub sandwich. Guillermo del Toro. Oh, Lupita Nyong'o. Do you got some red vines for me? Junior mints? Reese's Cups? I'll have them right here. Thank you, Gal Gadot. I will enjoy all of that candy. And I don't need my picture taken with you. I just need free food.
That's right.
Okay, so movies. We caught up on one.
Yes.
We caught up on Every Day.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps you have no idea what that is. It's certainly understandable if you have no idea what that is.
If you are over the age of 25, it has not been marketed to you at all.
Listen, if you're under the age of 25, it has not been marketed to you at all.
You don't know. There could be ads on, like...
Where?
Whatever Teen Nick is calling itself these days.
In 2 weeks, I'm looking at the Box Office Mojo chart right now. In 2 weeks of release, we didn't even get to it last week. It opened last week. We didn't have a chance to talk about it because neither one of us had seen it.
They screened it one time for press.
Yeah. In 2 weeks, it has made a grand total of $5 million. And it's on, it was on over 2,000 screens. And after 1 week, it dropped down to 1,600 screens. Mm. And it's going to drop even harder as it goes along.
But hey, Orion's back.
Why don't you explain what you're talking about?
Orion Pictures was a very big deal in the 1980s. They won 2 Best Picture Oscars in a row with Dances with Wolves and Silence of the Lambs. They were Woody Allen's distributor during a good part of his career, and I mean a good part of his career.
Right.
The
part where we all liked him.
The part that was good.
Yeah.
You know, they released, like, a lot of good stuff. Like, they were of indie studios. They were mainly formed, I think, by people who jumped ship from United Artists pre-Heaven's Gate. You know, they were a very big deal studio, and then they went belly up, and they've been non-existent for a couple of decades. But this, I think, is the first movie to go out with the Orion imprint on it in quite some time.
So it stars
Anguri Rice.
Anguri Rice. That's an unusual first name.
Yes.
I don't know where that name comes from. I'm curious about that.
She's Australian.
Oh, is she?
Yeah. She's the daughter from The Nice Guys.
The Nice Guys. She was also in The Beguiled.
Correct.
She was one of the girls.
Yes.
In The Beguiled. She was in Spider-Man Homecoming. Hmm. And now she plays a girl named Rhiannon.
Yes.
Like the song.
I was going to say, it's never made clear that her parents were big Fleetwood Mac fans. Were left to sort of...
Her parents are played by...
Infer that.
Her parents were played by Maria Bello and some Canadian guy.
Yes, who I thought kind of looked like Steve Zahn, and Dave said did not.
That is incorrect. He does not.
He looks kind of like Steve Zahn.
And all right. So she has a boyfriend. His name is Justin. He's
a jerk.
He's a bit of a jerk to her, yes. But magically, one day, he says, hey, let's skip school. And he gives her...
Actually, she says, let's skip school.
Well, yeah, she does, doesn't she? Yeah.
But nonetheless, they have a...
But he's into it.
They have a lovely day, and he is sweet and kind to her and says all the right things and gets her to open up about her family issues and is like the perfect ideal boyfriend for the day.
And then the next day...
He is back to being a jerk.
Back to being a jerk. But that's fine, because what we learn is that someone new has come along on that next day and is as into her on that day as her boyfriend was the day before.
You're telling this all wrong.
Because am I?
The next time they cross paths, this person is a girl who claims...
I was getting to that part.
You're telling it all out of order. The next day, a girl shows up at school and says, hey, I'm new here and I need somebody to show me around. And so has Rhiannon show her around. And when Justin shows up
says... I was getting to that part.
...says stupid stuff, the new girl's like, why don't you back off, jerk?
The reason that she says those things is because she's as into Aguri Rice on that day as Justin the boyfriend was the day before, which was what I was getting to.
Well, but she's...
I was just taking a little more detailed time get to the point of that.
She's expressing it differently.
That's all. I knew where I was going.
She's not like vamping her or anything.
Trying to say that I knew where I was going with this explanation.
You're doing this all wrong.
Then keep talking and explain the rest of the movie.
So then at a big teen American party, red Solo cups and everything, this guy shows up claiming to be the cousin of the host, and he gets flirty with her and dances with her to the song that she and nice Justin had listened to, which jerk Justin completely ignores.
That song is
The Vuzz, This Is The Day.
Yeah, which kids that age would know, perhaps, if they watched Empire Records over and over and over again on some sort of pay cable situation. TNT, perhaps.
Entirely
possible. USA Network. We don't know.
But, you know, look, kids sometimes like a random old song for whatever reason. Their parents
sometimes.
Or they just encounter online or whatever.
Sometimes.
Anyway, so he's talking to her in a very cute way and keeps Justin at bay by pretending to be gay, but he's not. And anyway, what... Turns out what is happening here is there is a sort of free-floating spirit who names itself A. And A lands in a different person every day. Somebody around the same age in the same geographical vicinity. And A happened to turn into Justin one day and fell in love with Rhiannon. And so now every day, wherever A lands, A tries to find Rhiannon and... It takes several days and several identities for A to convince Rhiannon that this is really a thing that's happening and she's not being, you know, catfished or losing her mind.
Right.
And so then it becomes a thing where she falls in love with A. And so every day it's trying to figure out, what is A going to be, a boy or a girl or a gender non-binary teen? Is A going to be black or white or Asian or something else? You know, there's a sort of a metaphor there about falling in love for the person inside, that the externals don't matter, that I think the movie kind of embraces and then sort of walks away from. At least that was my take on it. But I think you liked it more than I did. I know Dan Waters, author of the original Heathers,
yes,
likes it much more than I do. So it's got that in its favor.
I believe that as a technical piece of filmmaking, it's not great. It is not a particularly well-balanced movie. We don't learn, I think, enough about her, the female Rhiannon. And I wish that they had gone deeper into the idea of...
Who is she outside of the context of this relationship?
Well, that, but also the ramifications of this kind of relationship, which they touch on just a little bit near the end.
Yeah.
When she's questioned, like, what's going to happen
right
when we get older? how will this work? How will this function in real life
yeah.
when we get older if we stay together?
Yeah. Because at some point, A figures out that A can stay in a person for a while.
But not forever.
Yeah. No, he could. A could forever, but.
But then you rob that person of their other self.
At the risk of, yeah. exactly, not yeah. allowing this person. So, and I kept thinking, are they just going to like work out some ending where they're going to find somebody who's in a coma or something? Like, I didn't know how that was going to play.
Well, they could have. They could have. That would have been an option. Yeah. I wish, like you said, I wish it had gone deeper into the idea of, well, what if the person who shows up is not at all in the body you were imagining?
Right.
Your love might be in, you know. What if it's not the gender you think you're attracted to? What if it's a person who is, like you said earlier, just a non-binary person,
yeah.
you know?
Or the race that you weren't expecting.
Yeah, or the body shape.
Yeah.
Because one of the guys who shows up is a big, round young man.
Yes.
You know? And so, who, in fact, was also in Spider-Man Homecoming.
Yes.
That's Ned from Spider-Man yes. Homecoming.
Who doesn't get to get out of the booth of a diner during his one scene.
He just explains a lot to
yeah,
her.
Yeah, yeah, he is like, hi, I'm an exposition dump.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But here's what I did like about it quite a bit. I like that, first of all, I love the idea of this
oh,
movie.
Yeah, no, I'm totally down for
it. And I'm glad it got made.
Yeah.
I'm also glad that it does a thing that teenage movies do a lot, but never cop to. And again, I wish it had gone deeper into this idea without it just having to be subtext. But it goes into that very teenage phenomenon of everything feeling incredibly urgent right now, very important right now. We don't care about tomorrow. We care about right now. Because if I don't take this thing right now, it'll disappear forever. And in this film, it literally will disappear forever.
True.
After tomorrow. After today.
After today, A will be someone else
yes.
entirely.
So there's that idea. There's also the idea that teenage love is, for the teenagers involved in it, so urgently, vitally important.
And permanent.
And permanent. It's going to be forever.
Yeah.
And when that first heartbreak happens or that second one happens, you think, oh no, I'm doomed.
I'll never love again.
I will never love again. My life is actually over. And as you get older, into your late teens, your early 20s, your 30s perhaps, you realize, oh, okay. So all of those other times that I was in love, those were the training wheels.
Right. Now I get a do-over.
This is why it's so good that more and more queer teenagers get to come out when they are teenagers. Hopefully also get to experience those first romances mm-hmm. as teenagers.
And not, say, in their 20s
or 30s. Or 30s, yes. Because, I'm 53, and I know people who, when they were my age as teenagers, they were already, you know, out and running around, and, you know.
The highs and the lows.
Yeah, but for someone like me, I didn't come out until I was in my mid-20s, and I didn't start dating until my very late 20s, and I was never a teenager in love.
Nope, me neither.
Nope, and so all those things that you have to learn through the process, through the trial and error of having your heart broken or being with people, for a lot of queer people, that takes place later. It takes place in their 20s. It takes place in their 30s, sometimes even later.
Yeah.
And when I see this a lot with, I can only speak to the experiences of, you know, gay and bisexual men, but who just completely rag on each other all the time about being immature. And I'm like, well, dude, that's because you're doing stuff you should have done. You're catching up. You're doing things that teenagers did when they were teenagers.
Yeah, there's the phrase gay adolescence exists for a reason.
And
it's like exactly. it doesn't necessarily take place during your physical adolescence.
Yeah. So anyway, I like that this movie goes into that.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't do it, again, I think, with enough complexity or enough specificity.
Yeah.
But I like that. I like that quality. And I like it when a film about teenagers
addresses
it and realizes, you know, even if it's subtextual, like here, I like it when that happens.
And yeah, it's not bad. I really like the casting. Like Bibbs reviewed this movie for The Wrap, and like, you know, specifically pointed out the whoever was the casting director, I don't have his or her name in front of me, but had to find a bunch of appealing young actors who had to make an impact in a brief amount of time.
Yes.
Because A is constantly hopping from person to person.
Yes.
So you have like one or two scenes with somebody and then bam, we're off to the next one.
Yeah.
So each one of those people has to be immediately kind of compelling enough to suck you in and make you keep you interested in it.
The film even addresses the issue of consent from Rhiannon's perspective,
mm-hmm.
because she not only on that very first time doesn't know that her boyfriend is being inhabited by this new spirit.
Uh-huh.
On one day, the spirit inhabits her body.
Right.
So she is A for one day.
Yeah.
And at one point she says, did anyone bother to ask me if I was into this? Like, when were you going to tell me that you were being a different person? Like, each 24-hour time slot. And then the answer, of course, was, well, I'm sorry. I have no control.
Yeah, I wouldn't have done it on purpose.
Yeah. And that is also an important conversation for characters to have.
And I think, and this may have worked.
And they did kind of.
This may have worked better.
And as good as you, it is as well as you could have had that conversation in a film about a supernatural entity that, you know, drops in for your romance.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I think this might have worked better in the book. The movie, I think, has to spend a lot of time explaining this concept and,
yes,
like explaining the ramifications of it. Like, there's a whole sequence where A wakes up in a teenager whose family is about to fly to Hawaii, and he has to run away. So because then he'll be stuck in Hawaii forever because, you know, he's always sort of stuck geographically. A specifically says that A has no gender, but
right,
you know, and so
it,
yeah,
it, I, the no, the entity that is a spirit,
they,
yeah,
I feel,
or
like,
they, yes,
the movie, I think, has to spend so much time just laying out the ground rules of this cockamamie, you know, structure that's time we could have spent with other characters and other ideas.
Yeah.
Also, kudos to TV's Jessie, whom I did not recognize.
As the sister whose character was diminished in the script somehow, some way.
Yeah.
Because she's far more interesting than the movie ever allows you to know.
Yeah.
She's like hard-bitten and
nose ring.
And, you know, she's a wild thing. And,
yeah.
Cynical,
talks tough.
Talks tough, yeah. I would have liked to hear more about her.
Yeah.
But she's only just there, son of his comic relief.
What's her name? Something Ryan?
Debbie Ryan. Yeah.
So.
So yeah, this is an interesting movie. I'm glad it exists because it keeps that it keeps the narrative of gender and bodies and
I can see
and affection and love and how very fluid all of that can be.
Yeah. I can see people using this movie as a touchstone for explaining things the way that, like, kids might use Inside Out.
Right.
To talk about their,
yes,
feelings.
Yeah.
I could see a teenager who falls in love with somebody who is seemingly inappropriate and citing
to this, everyone around that person.
Yeah, yeah. And sort of citing this movie as, no, you don't get it. Like, it's, you look past the this and the that, and it's, you know, this,
it's not a perfect movie, but it's not terrible.
It's not terrible, and yeah, it wants to do something, and, you know, like, watch it on cable.
It's being sold as sort of a schmoopy teen romance.
Yeah, they're giving it the Nicholas Sparks look, and it's directed by Michael Soucy, who directed The Vow, which is not a Nicholas Sparks movie, but everybody thinks is a Nicholas Sparks movie. He also did the made for TV, the HBO Grey Gardens with Jessica Lange and Drew Barrymore.
Okay, please to talk about Horror School.
Oh, you sent me to Horror School.
You saw Red Sparrow.
Uh-huh.
I saw Death Wish.
Yes. Who came out the worst? You deserve.
Go.
All right. So Red Sparrow stars Jennifer Lawrence as Bolshoi Dancer.
Okay.
Okay, I'm not going to do
that. Like
anymore.
You. Yeah.
Busan Squirrel. And she, the terrible onstage dancing accident breaks her leg, can never dance again. Her mother, Jolie Richardson, is suffering from vaguely spelled out awful movie disease. And the only way to continue to afford their apartment and medical care is by Jennifer Lawrence doing spy things for her shifty uncle, played by Matthias Skinnerts. He asks her to seduce this guy who was a big fan of her when she was a dancer. They go up to his hotel room. He is about to rape her, and suddenly somebody swoops in and strangles this guy. And it looks like she's going to be killed as well because she was a witness, but her other choice is to become a sparrow, which is basically a sexy spy who learns all the sexy things to seduce people to give up information and blah, blah, blah.
Okay.
If you watch The Americans, you will recall the flashbacks to seductive spy school that were horrifying. If you saw Avengers Age of Ultron, you'll recall the flashbacks to Soviet spy training. Both those movies are way more interesting than this one. Jennifer Lawrence gets sent after an American CIA agent played by Joel Edgerton, who is not convincingly American, and the two of them have zero chemistry, and that's a problem because we're supposed to believe that he is convincing her to be a double agent for the Americans because of their love times. And she, meanwhile, is pursuing her own agenda. And it's the kind of movie where you can tell that she's lying to everybody. And movies like that, I tend to tune out on until the last 5 minutes when there's a montage that shows me what was really going on all along and weren't they clever. And this is one of those movies. And yes, there are twists, but there are twists that you know are coming. And even if you don't know specifically what the twists are, you know they are twists. If this had been a dumber movie, it would have been a lot more fun. If it had been the sort of campy movie that Charlotte Rampling thinks that she is in as the headmistress of the of Horror School, or Jeremy Irons as a general, or Mary Louise Parker as a boozy American informant. I don't know what the heck she is.
Right.
But no, this movie takes itself super seriously, even though it's the kind of movie where Jennifer Lawrence goes from brunette to blonde with one box of Hungarian drugstore hair dye.
It could happen.
And then immediately gets into a swimming pool.
Could totally happen.
A swimming pool where she is doing laps in the most ridiculous, like, cutouts. Margie, our close friend, who, if you listen to Linoleum Knife and Fork, if you're a Patreon subscriber at patreon.com/linoleumknife, she immediately texted me to say, as a frequent lap swimmer, let me just tell you, those suits were ridiculous. And they are like the most like décolletage side boob bathing suits
that
no one is exercising in. But she's wearing them to the lap pool so she can chat up Joel Edgerton.
Why can't a person be sexy everywhere they go?
If this movie had committed to dumbness, I would have enjoyed it. Like, if the whole movie had been pitched to the level of Jennifer Lawrence telling Matthias Skinnerts, "You sent me to horse school," I would have had a great time. Sadly, it is not.
Okay, fine.
Death Wish, do tell.
Well, it's the latest from Eli Roth.
Oh, good.
Now, you know I like Eli Roth.
You do, actually.
I was the only person I know, besides Aaron, good friend Aaron, who liked Green Inferno, the cannibal movie about the cannibals that heroically eat
American college students.
Visiting American college students. So this one is a remake of the 1970s Charles Bronson super hit movie.
Yes.
Death Wish. About a man whose wife and daughter are viciously attacked. And the wife is killed. And so the guy goes on a vigilante street justice spree, putting bullets in the heads of bad people. This one stars Bruce Willis as the surgeon whose life is turned upside down by bad people. The bad people come to his house and they kill his wife, Elizabeth Shue.
Not Elizabeth Shue.
Yeah. You know, you see Elizabeth Shue in the first opening moments and you think, oh, I really dig Elizabeth Shue. And then you think, oh no, damn it, she's the wife and this is Death Wish. This is going to not end well for Elizabeth Shue. She gets killed. Bad people. So then the daughter's in a coma. And he's frustrated by the fact that, you know, no one can solve the crime.
Mm.
Not Detective Dean Norris of Breaking Bad.
And the Book of Henry.
Not Detective Kimberly Elise. They're too slow. So
sometimes a surgeon just has to take the law into his own
sometimes
hands.
You gotta get a gun. You gotta go out and start shooting people in the face. So he does that. He does it a lot.
Now, the racial politics of the original are iffy at best.
Same here.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Although, I can imagine that Mr. Roth would say, well, look, there are lots of people of color on the good side of the law in this film, and they are all on camera as well. And there are white people on the bad side of the law. So he mixes it up.
Uh-huh. So Kimberly Elise is supposed to make up for however...
Not just Kimberly Elise, but other, you know, other characters. So, yeah, they are... It's still racist. It's still completely racist.
Is there anything in this movie that justifies doing this movie again? Is there some idea behind it or some twist on, or is it just a really offensive movie, all the more so given our current culture of guns and whatnot?
We are never in a deficit. We the culture,
mm-hmm.
film culture, cinema is never in short supply of movies about dudes who take the law into their own hands to kill the bad guys. When the real law enforcement people of the world
are too inept
to do their job.
Liam Neeson has built an entire late career out of this.
For example. And I personally do not have a problem with films about this sort of thing. They are an escapist fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with these films in the United States is that they are an escapist fantasy that dumb people have decided are a how-to book.
Are potential scenarios.
Yes. Because the theme of this movie is a good guy with a gun.
Oh, good.
And, I mean, studies have shown that the good guy with a gun situation is statistically insignificant.
Yeah.
You hear about the good guy with the gun taking care of business every time it happens because it happens so infrequently.
Right.
So very often.
The good guy with the gun who shoots the wrong guy.
The good guy with the gun isn't there.
The 4-year-old son of the good guy with the gun finds the gun.
Yeah. There are far more, you know, instances of the good guy with the gun having his gun taken from him and used against him or used on a family member or used accidentally or used as a suicide attempt or, you know.
Yeah.
Or simply that good guy with a gun just not being on the scene of the crime that is being committed. And there was no good guy with a gun with the aim of American Sniper, who, right. by the way, was also killed by a very troubled man with a gun.
Indeed.
So it's a bad idea to take films like this and think that you can construct a worldview out of them, because you simply cannot if you are intellectually honest. It is perfectly fine to enjoy these films as they are for what they are, which right. is a Wizard of Oz-level fantasy.
Well, yeah, they make as okay. much sense as, like, if I can get bitten by a radioactive spider, then...
Right. This particular one is... Like I say, it's as kind of, sort of, pretty much racist as the original back in the 70s. In spite of the fact that it's got, you know, like I said, white people, white bad people and good people of color. It is set in Chicago.
Oh, boy.
Which is every conservative right-wing person's favorite example of a city that is allegedly out of control.
American Cottage.
Yes. Because there is so much gun violence happening there. And so it takes that situation and transposes it to, you know, this gorgeous neighborhood where the doctor lives and, you know, bad and, you know,
does
bad,
he live in Shermer?
He lives in he does. This is a John Hughes joint. So anyway, it is an opportunistic film.
Mm-hmm.
To take a real and terrible situation that is taking place in Chicago and making it all about, like, this white doctor and his family. And so...
white victim and white savior all rolled into one.
Yes. The most irritating aspect of this film is that it is boring.
Oh, dear.
And not suspenseful. The other most irritating aspect of this film is that we have to be subjected to the frequent voiceover pontificating of MTV's Sway.
Oh, Lordy.
Who is the moral conscience of the film. And he says, I just don't know about this Grim Reaper vigilante. Is he a good guy or is he a bad guy? Should we all be taking up arms to take the law into our own hands or should we not? And then, like, you know, his co-host, who the woman, I don't know her name, he's on Sirius. Sway. MTV's Sway is now on a Sirius channel, apparently. And she's all like, no, he's good. He's, you know... He's getting the bad guys. And then, on the flip side of it, is Man Cow.
Oh, sweet Jesus.
And you know you want to listen to every word out of Man Cow's mouth.
Yes, I was turned to heart. Morning DJs for their take on the moral ethical dilemmas of the day.
Oh, my God. Man Cow should have been like third build. He yaps so much over the... Ugh. Over the you know, narration. Yeah.
Now tell me this.
Yeah.
Does Bruce Willis bother to give a damn performance?
No. No.
Has that ship sailed? Is that the deal?
It might have. I think
unless Wes Anderson comes calling, like can't be bothered.
He is practically inert in this film, Even in the beginning, when he's supposed to be so in love with his wife and, you know, caring for his daughter, it's just stone face. I'm like, what is your problem?
Well, I mean, you know, like after Cop Out, Kevin Smith was like, boy, I was so excited to direct Bruce Willis, and he just is not.
Remember when he had a spark in his eyes and he had life in him? And
there was a glint of something.
I don't know what happened with him, but I haven't seen a film outside of Wes Anderson. I haven't seen a film with him in years where I thought, oh, you act like you care that you're in this movie.
Yeah, you came to play. You know?
So, you know, Here's the thing about this film being offensive in terms of its release date. When is a good time to release these movies anymore?
Well, sure. No, Ira Madison pointed
out.
With
the mass shooting crisis that is taking place in the United States, is there a time when we can just enjoy a guy in a movie going blam, blam, blam with bad guys?
Ira Madison pointed out when Paramount pulled the premiere of Heathers because of the Parkland shooting.
Yeah.
And he was like, good luck trying to stay ahead of a school shooting.
Yeah.
Because when isn't there?
What are you going to do with this stuff? Yeah. You know, do you simply back off from this subject matter?
Oh, that's not happening.
From black comedies like Heathers, the Heathers reboot that apparently everyone hates. I haven't seen it at all yet. We're going to watch every episode, I know.
Yes.
Just because we got to know
what's
happening
and
on that
show. And we have a friend who's on it, and the aforementioned Mr. Waters likes the show.
Oh, does he?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm curious to see. I know we can watch the pilot still. Is it still
online?
I
don't
online?
Know if they pulled it
have they
too
pulled
or
that
not.
As
I
well?
No, we may have missed our window.
Well, eventually it will surface and we'll get to watch it. But, you know, until the powerful lobbying group, the NRA, stops buying politicians, mm-hmm. and until those politicians start voting with their consciences, or until we vote out those politicians, nothing is going to change in the United States. Yeah. And we will not have reasonable gun control measures that will either stop or delay or minimize the relentless barrage of gun violence in the United States. It's just so if you're going to watch a movie like this, you're going to have to make a leap in your brain of, okay, well, this is the Wizard of Oz. Like this is
magical fantasy gun universe.
This is magical fantasy gun land where justice is done and good people triumph with their guns and their hands don't shake and they aren't scared. And literally Bruce Willis is holding two, you know, automatic weapons and shooting the bullets at the same time. That really happens.
And only the guilty are hit by bullets.
So, it's bad.
I think
it's bad. It's bad. It's a bad movie.
Yeah, and if it's boring, then
also it is.
Why even talk about the ethics of it? It's just if it's boring, then
there's one cool vigilante death that does not involve a gun. It is because Eli Roth loves a good gory death, and a gun is just sort of like a.
Does somebody get crushed by an elevator or something?
A car, and it's
in the trailer.
It's fun. That's a fun head splatter. Death, if you like that kind of thing, and I do.
You do.
You know, I'm sad there were no cannibals to eat the body to eat the bodies of the bad people when they died.
All that lead, you know.
Spit them out. Spit out them bullets. I mean, you're chomping on a leg like that.
Anyway.
More cannibal movies, please. Eli Roth.
Is that everything?
Pro-cannibal. No.
Oh, right. Yes, you saw.
I saw.
Lamar Luttrell.
I saw a really wonderful documentary called Elmar Lamar. Now, can you translate what that means?
Elmar is the sea, and Lamar, I don't know. Let me...
So we paused the recording equipment, and we looked it all up, and... Mar is a masculine noun.
In Spain.
In Spain. Well, hang on. It is normally masculine, but in poetry, and here's the explanation, and sailor's speech, it is feminine.
Well, you know, my life, my love, and my lady is the sea.
Correct.
I suppose if you are a sailor and you are staring at it all the time, then you make Elmar Lamar.
I suppose. In any case, translation, the sea. The sea. There is no sea in this film. It is from the Harvard Sensory Ethnography Lab. My beloved Harvard Sensory Ethnography Lab. You laugh.
No, I know.
I'm in a great romance with
you
them.
You're a big fan. You need a Harvard Sensory Ethnography Lab t-shirt you can wear.
If they have them, I'll get one. Because boy, am I a fan. They're the people responsible for Sweetgrass, for Leviathan, not the Russian Leviathan that won the Foreign Language Oscar, but the Leviathan about the fishing boat.
Right.
And, of course, Mana Kamana.
Yes.
Which I took you to in the most triumphant manner.
Go back and...
I tricked you into seeing it, and you loved me for it.
Go back and listen to the Mana Kamana show for that story. We can hardly do it justice now. You'll just have to go back and listen to that episode. M-A-N-A-K-A-M-A-N-A.
In any case, this is the new film. From J.P. Sniadecki and Joshua Bonetta.
So there's no sea in it. What is in it?
The Sonoran Desert. And the first few minutes of it are kind of an indecipherable image because it's from a car. And what you find after a few moments and the camera pulls back a little bit, you're watching from a moving car the fence that divides the United States and Mexico. And the, the plant life all around that. Now, the film is divided into three parts. And they are, those three parts are dominated by voiceover. Often, they are taking place in pitch blackness. It's footage that's taking place at night, focused on the landscape. Sometimes you'll see a light in the distance. You don't know what that light is. It might be a car coming. It might just be a flashlight. But there will be voiceovers from people who have lived out there, in the desert at the border. People who have crossed the border to come into the United States. You'll hear from Border Patrol voiceover. You'll hear about people who have seen strange things in the desert, very often at night. People who got lost trying to find their way. Stories of people who have encountered other people who got lost. The daylight footage is perhaps less frightening, but more sorrowful because the daytime footage involves discarded items. So, a pair of glasses, or a backpack, or a water jug, or a child's doll, or something else that indicates a story that you are never going to know. People talk about finding bodies out there. The footage that is shot in the daylight, or at least with some light in it, is it's beautiful. It also has a lot in common with sort of like landscape documentary where, quite frankly, not a lot happens.
Like Rivers and Tides, that kind of thing?
Well, no, but that's a documentary about a landscape artist. Oh, that's okay. Different. So this is no BS. This is an experimental avant-garde documentary in its form.
Slow cinema.
Not slow, just visually often quite abstract.
Okay.
And like I said, 50% of it, a good 50% of this film, takes place in complete darkness. And you are just reading translated voiceover on this black screen. But if you're looking at the screen, you realize that the camera is pointed out at the desert because you'll see and you'll hear noises, sometimes very spooky horror movie kind of noises, but you will see lights. And the mystery of those lights is, again, sometimes quite unsettling and frightening. It is an unnerving, sort of anxiety provoking movie. If you're the kind of person who is A, afraid of the dark, B, afraid of being lost. And it's quite sad because it takes the idea of the border and people who live near it and people who cross it and how they interact. It takes all the sensationalism and all the histrionic, talking points out of the equation and simply leaves you with stories and images that make you construct your own narratives, or at least listen, because you have nothing to do but listen to people who have actually lived this experience. It's a beautiful film. I highly recommend it. It is from Cinema Guild.
Ah.
They are the distributors. And if you go to the Cinema Guild website, you will see a list of dates and venues, museums, college campuses. It recently opened in New York. It played a week in New York, at least a week. It might still be there for all I know. It was here last week in Los Angeles for one night only.
And never again.
Acropolis Cinema. If you live in Los Angeles, keep track of Acropolis and what they do, because they bring films that are otherwise not getting love from local theaters. Mm-hmm. Theaters aren't booking little films like this. Because an audience for a film like this is not guaranteed. You know, it's a specialized audience. But I believe in that audience's what's the right word? Silent appreciation. Because I think more people would see these films if they knew they existed, if they actually were in theaters, if they got the kind of press that they needed. Yeah, this is not a normal movie by, multiplex standards.
It's kind of an Ouroboro. Like, is no one seeing it because they can't see it?
Yes.
Can they not see it because no one wants to see it? Yeah.
It has become a little bit my obsession for the past 7 years while we've done this podcast. And also before starting this podcast. I can never stop talking about films like this because I don't want them to disappear.
Sure.
Like, if I don't see it and I don't talk about it and I don't review it here or somewhere, the people listening to this show might never know it exists. Like, I feel like that's kind of my purpose sometimes on this podcast, is like making sure that, we know it exists and it's there and it's worth seeing. And if you know you like this kind of thing, or even if you think you just want to give it a try, here it is. Go listen to the episode where I take Alonzo to see Monica Mana, because he learned a very valuable lesson that day. He learned that I'm always right.
Oh, Lord. I was actually just going to correct something you said earlier, which is that you don't have a purpose on this podcast.
My purpose is to be a heroic champion and to make you watch movies like Monica Mana and to tell everyone over and over and over again to see films like Elmar Lamar.
Mm-hmm.
New for 2018. It'll be on my top 10 list at the end of the year.
Well,
I guarantee you that. If I do one, I didn't really do one this year.
I was going to say, you didn't even write one this year.
I made one for the...
Don't go making promises.
What I did, though, I did write one. I talked about it on the podcast when Manola and Robert were here. And I just didn't like publish it anywhere. Mm-hmm. I just gave you titles. It
doesn't count.
It does count because this show exists. And I am somebody.
Ain't you a woman? Anyway, thank you for, sticking up for the little lost movies that otherwise aren't getting much love.
Elmar Lamar.
Yes.
CinemaGuild.com.
What's your DVD pick this
week? I ain't got one. I don't. we started recording this podcast, and I was like, oh, wait, I don't have anything to talk about video-wise.
Something that ties into...
Emir Kusturica's Underground just came out on Blu-ray. There I haven't watched it yet. I've never seen it. But now I have a Blu-ray, and I'm very excited.
Okay, that works.
Okay.
I'm going to say...
And that Blu-ray has the three-hour version that won the Palme d'Or at Cannes in mm-hmm. the 90s, and the six-hour television version.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh?
Yeah.
All right.
This is considered... like his greatest film.
I like me some Kusturica.
Yeah, so...
Okay.
Eventually, I'll sit down and watch it eventually. I'm not saying it's going to happen this week.
It may be next Super Bowl.
It might be. That, you know what, that would be... We could hang on to that till next Super Bowl and make it the super long Sunday.
Maybe we'll have time between now.
Maybe we will.
Now and next January.
Perhaps.
To watch it. I'm going to say Nobody's Fool. I was thinking about... when we were talking about when Bruce Willis actually bothered to show up and act, he's quite good in that movie. It stars Paul Newman. It's a very charming character study. I think it's one of Newman's last films. And Jessica Tandy is in it, and one of the better Melanie Griffith performances, and a very young Philip Seymour Hoffman. It's a movie I like a lot.
Really?
from Robert Benton. So, yeah, Nobody's Fool. That's my pick this week.
So, you told me you had two letters for me. One was kind of long and one was kind of short, but I don't have the long one here in my email box. So what's up?
I suspect you're not looking.
No, I'm totally looking because you send them all from the Linoleum Knife podcast email, and I've only got one from Jeremy.
I'm going to pause for a second and school you one moment.
Okay.
Okay, it's being weird, so I'm going to read it off my phone. This is a letter from Eric from early January. Sorry, we're a little behind. Hey, guys, I must confess that I'm a few episodes behind. Oh, well, fine, we're even then. So maybe this was addressed on a previous episode or in the letters episode. I was wondering how you felt about the state of entertainment criticism in the current social media and content creation-dominated landscape. I'm a big consumer of television and to a lesser degree of movies, and I read and watch and listen to a decent amount of entertainment criticism, obviously LK and What the Flick, but also smaller content creators on YouTube for certain shows like Doctor Who, for example. Sometimes I feel like all the criticism makes most entertainment difficult to enjoy. I will watch something and then read, watch, listen to feedback from others online, and even when I very much enjoyed something, it's sort of ruined when the critical masses are negative. It reminds me of when I was a child and my mother would take me to a store and I would ask for something, say a toy or food, and she would refuse. I would beg for 20 minutes and then she would relent. Of course, I then would not enjoy the thing that I'd wanted in the first place because of the grief and frustration and guilt that was created in getting it. Of course, sometimes little me was just a greedy a-hole, but with the consumption of a TV show or movie, it seems unjust that just because others do not enjoy something that I should not either. I realize much blame lies with me for feeling guilty or stupid when online critics I respect, or at least enjoy following, hate or chide something I liked or even loved. It sometimes feels like we didn't watch the same thing. However, it does feel like the pool of criticism is overflowing. There are too many cooks in the kitchen, and it's tough to find a good meal with so many dishes being served. So my bigger question to you guys is, how do you feel about the state of entertainment criticism? As possibly more qualified and more thoughtful critics, do you feel lesser critics show your whole field in a bad light? Does the ability for anyone to post a review or a piece of entertainment help or hinder the art of criticism? Does social media really make it hard to enjoy something the masses already declared terrible but you enjoy? I know this is a giant question with many facets, and you've probably been asked similar questions before, but I wanted to hear what you guys thought and maybe any advice for listeners / consumers of criticism or for would-be critics to ameliorate some of the issues I've highlighted. Thanks and Happy New Year, Eric.
I have an answer.
Go on.
You and I have spent the bulk of our lives, and we are now old people.
Mm-hmm.
You're 50, I'm 53. You and I have spent the bulk of our lives watching, studying, reading about, writing about, learning about, actively seeking out the cinema. Not primarily as fans, I would say more as students. You chose this profession at a young age. You knew what you wanted right away when you were a kid, and you just kept on doing it. I came to it later, after being a teacher. But even before I came to this job in 1999, I was, you know,
a critical consumer.
I was the layperson that who wanted more and had the curiosity for more.
Mm-hmm.
If I had had the internet in 1999, or rather in 1989,
yeah,
I would have been an enthusiastic amateur critic who could not write very well. The first 10 years of my film writing career about film was spent not really writing proper reviews, but instead writing for websites that that just wanted me to be fun.
Mm-hmm.
And I got an audience that way. And then I feel I became a film critic when I was, you know, forced to write proper film reviews.
Right.
I believe in what you and I do here on this show that we have and have now been doing for 7+ years. And I don't give a damn about what anyone else is doing. Not to say that I don't listen to other film podcasts or that I don't care about what other film critics say, but I have chosen the people whose opinions I value, even if they drastically, radically
disagree
with me.
Yeah.
You know who's great? Ingu Kang. Do you know who says things that I shake my head at half the time? Ingu Kang.
I would put Richard Brody in that category,
Richard
too.
Richard Brody does the same thing.
He's great. And we rarely agree.
And so I have found my critical voices in the world, and I pay attention to them. And if they hate something, really, really hate something that I love, it doesn't make me feel bad.
Or wrong.
It makes me think, okay, I'm going to go back and look at this film maybe again and try to see what they see.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm going to read more from them so I can get a better perspective on maybe this particular type of film is something that they habitually dislike.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because every film critic, no matter how great they are, every film critic has habits, viewing habits, viewing preferences.
They have druthers.
They have, yeah, genres they like more than others. And so, you know, that's good to learn about those people.
Yeah. I love reading Pauline Kael. Do I always trust her about
anything?
De Palma no. and Altman? No. Or anything? No. Yeah.
So I think the state of it now, that there's a glut.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a glut.
Yeah.
Everybody can and everybody is. You go find the ones that you believe in intellectually and from a goodness, you know, perspective. Like, do they seem to be arguing things in good faith? Do you prefer genre film and the fanboy approach? I hate to say that in a way that sounds disparaging, because I'm not disparaging that approach at all. It's out there and it's got a presence and it's valuable. It's not my thing, but I know plenty of people who do that kind of thing, and I think those people are great. So, you know, pick what you're about.
It is up to the consumer of criticism now to shop around. There was a time when there were fewer outlets, there were fewer writers, and I think a lot of people got a lot of mileage out of the fact that, oh, well, I write for the New York Times, I wrote for the New Republic, and that in and of itself was enough to sort of establish him or her as an important presence in the world of criticism.
Yes.
And now, you know, there are very few stable jobs, and there are a lot of people who are passionate amateurs, and you kind of have to sort of, look at them, see who you think has interesting ideas, expresses them well, and don't take it personally when they don't agree with you. Like what you like and dislike what you dislike as an individual human being. And, you know,
maybe read less criticism if, you know, you feel bombarded with the stuff that's out there. You're never going to read all of it, heaven knows.
And you're never going to see every film.
Yeah. So just, like, allow yourself to stick to the ones that you know are going to be, you know, provocative for you, or going to make you think about things in a different way, or who will put into words how you feel about things but don't quite know how to, you know, describe. But yeah, I mean, if I can give you one piece of advice out of that whole long thing, letter, it's like what you like, and don't even let people who you respect talk you out of it.
Correct. I have a related letter.
Yes.
It's from Jeremy.
Mm-hmm.
Friend of show Jeremy.
Ah.
From Houston. I recently started a job with a fairly long commute. I've come back to the world of podcasts for the first time in a very long time. I have to say, it's great to hear your wonderful voices again.
Oh.
So, Jeremy, what you're saying is that you ignored us for a while.
Yeah.
Well, what kind of friend are you?
We're going to paper that over and just go with the compliment, I guess.
What's your problem? I also started writing reviews for the first time ever, and my question to both of you, which you may have already answered before on the show, like 5 seconds ago, is what advice would you have for someone that's starting out in movie criticism? Thanks in advance. Keep on making cool stuff. P.S. Dave, we miss you on social media. Come back. Maybe. Here's my advice. Have a job that isn't movie criticism.
Yes.
One that actually pays your bills. One that makes your living so that you aren't always trying to out hustle to get movie review jobs.
Yes. Enjoy
it. That's number one.
Enjoy it as a side pursuit.
If your side hustle turns into your hustle, lucky you. Good for you.
It's the American dream.
Congratulations. If it doesn't, that's life. I'm not saying that flippantly. How many film critic friends have we known in the past 10 years who have simply quit altogether?
Or lost a plum gig or two.
Not only lost a plum gig or two, but quit the profession.
Yeah.
Went to do something else with their life.
Right.
Yeah. Because the jobs aren't there. If you and I had not started this podcast, and then if you and I had not found a way to monetize it in the minor way that we have.
Patreon.com/
Sure, yes. There's your commercial for the episode.
Oh, there's more.
I think that should be all. I think that should be the only advertisement. We have a Patreon subscription with other content and prizes that you can get. That's it. Patreon.com/linoleumknife. But if we had not... I'll tell you, when we launched that 2 years ago, we had no idea if people were going to want extra stuff from us, extra content, extra podcasts about things that weren't food, things that weren't film. You know, one of them
like food.
One of them is a food podcast. The other is a TV podcast. The other one's one that we sit around and swear on.
It's not all we do, but you know.
But it's the most charming part of it. So, have a safety net of work.
Yes. Right? Pay the rent.
Because, like I said, when we started the Patreon thing, we didn't know if anyone was going to care. And even now, like, we've been doing it 2 years, but it's still just a portion of a household income. Yeah. And so it is... it is a tough business to make a living at. But that's the only thing I want to talk about money-wise. I want to talk about film-wise. If you're going to be a film critic, you need to go do your homework. If you're new to doing the homework, go do your homework.
Yeah. Start
laying down a base of actual film history, know where things came from and who inspired whom and what the, you know, the movements along the lines have been over the years. And then also, like, you know, get a base knowledge of just the world in general. Be able to talk about art and music and, you know, photography and history and all the things that feed into movies, which is everything.
We just talked about the film Elmar Lamar,
mm-hmm.
which made us refer back to a review of a film called Monica Mana. That is a film about people taking a cable car up to a mountain shrine in Nepal. When I saw that film, I had to go do my homework about that thing so that I could discuss the film with some degree of, oh yeah, I've read something about this, and now I know a little bit more than I ever knew about anything from Nepal. If I see a film like, I reviewed a film last month for The Wrap called Asiambra about Romani people in Italy and, you know, their lives, which exist on the margins of the culture and often through, you know, criminal activity. I barely knew anything about them. I didn't know anything about the family that was really involved playing versions of themselves. I didn't know anything about the setting. So I went and I did my homework.
Right.
So,
but in addition to knowing about the movies that you're writing about, it's good to have sort of a base knowledge of a wider viewpoint that isn't just about movies, you know.
That's why I was talking about those two specific examples, because they are things that exist in the world that a person who is thoughtful might want to know about.
Right, but yeah. A movie may not always tell you what the homework is you're supposed to do for
it. You have to just go hunt.
So sometimes, you know, for example, it's good if you can walk into a movie and know that the cinematographer is referencing Caravaggio,
right,
or Matisse,
yes,
or, you know, whatever. You know, if you know the difference between expressionism and impressionism,
yes,
things like that. You know, I'm not saying you have to become an expert at everything on God's green earth, but
be curious enough about it to go do a little homework.
By all means.
Because if you're seeing a film that you don't understand, the movie's not stupid. You are. And I'm calling myself that.
Sure.
I have seen movies that I did not understand. And I knew walking out, hey, stupid, maybe you should go read about something like this so that you can now go back and watch that movie again.
And get it.
And maybe be less stupid. Oh, I am plenty stupid. Trust that.
Indeed. We all are.
So, yeah. Have a job. Do your homework.
And have fun.
Read, because not only do you learn to write by reading, but you learn to copy the people that you like.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes,
and eventually, then you develop your own way of writing,
yeah,
after you finish copying all the people you like.
Sometimes you'll learn what not to do.
For example. I guess that's all the advice I have.
Yeah, I mean, and just try not to get sucked into the whirlwind of marketing and of, you know, the thing of right now. You know, this is an art form that is over a century old, and, you know, large economic forces want to get you excited about a new movie for a very brief period of time, and then the world will move on. And so maybe think about the context of things when you're looking at something that's being hyped as the newest, the latest, the greatest, and, you know, write something that, you know, will make sense a year from now and not in the flush of all the ads.
Right. What is James Rocky, the anticipation industrial complex,
yes.
The anticipation industrial complex?
Yes.
Stay away from that.
Yeah.
It's
a sucker's game.
That's a hamster wheel. You don't want to be on it.
That too, yeah. It never ends.
All right, we're done.
All right. Well, hey, thank you all for listening. Thank you, Blue, for our theme music. Check out his great stuff at Bluetopia.com, Bluetopia. Go check out our friends on the internet. Go to ChristyLemire.com. Check out Canceled Too Soon and Critically Acclaimed with Bibbs and Whitney, The Schmoes Know, Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley, All Things Cozy, The Comics Canon, Fat Guys of the Movies, The Criterion Cast, Sewers of Paris, Film Spotting SVU, and Secretly Timid. If you check out the new episode of The Flophouse, they do Book of Henry, which is a movie that we enjoyed hating, and they do too. You can subscribe for free at Apple Podcasts. Please leave us a 5-star review there. It does help people find the show. You can also leave us positive feedback in all the places that we stream, including Stitcher Radio and TheLounge.com and Spotify and Google Play and CastBox and Podbean and Audible and all the other ones. We're out there everywhere. You can follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at LinoleumCast. Drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com with questions or comments. And hey, check out our Patreon page, patreon.com/linoleumknife. I snuck one more in there.
Yeah.
Because you want more of this.
Maybe you do.
And if you are going to be at the South by Southwest conference,
yep,
come see me on Sunday, March 11th at 5 p.m.
You called it the South by Southwest conference.
What is it?
Isn't it a film festival, music festival? It's a festival.
It's a bunch of things, yeah, but it's also a conference.
Oh, it is?
Yeah. I didn't just make that up.
Okay.
If you're going to be at... If you're going to be at South By, come to my panel, 5 o'clock on Sunday, March 11th. It's sponsored by TCM and Filmstruck. It's about the history of LGBT representation in cinema. I'm going to be talking with Dave Karger and Charlie Tabish, and it's going to be an interesting conversation. So hope you'll be there. Say hey. And until next time.
Oh, I forgot.
What?
The best thing about the Oscars last night.
What?
Jose Andres.
Yes. It would have been nice if they'd actually ID'd him on camera so people would know why that
My
guy was
chef crush
standing there. But it was nice to have all
Isn't
those.
He the cutest thing?
He's a... Yes. he's my countryman.
He was on that. He was on the stage because he has done so much
for Puerto Rico
work in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, they had activists on stage, but they didn't identify who any of them were, which was sort of pointless. But anyway, what are you going to do?
Nothing.
So until next time,
goodbye.